Blog Talk Radio.
Man, it's February. Here we go again. It's like the year's flying by, but we're all busy, right? Hey, and this is one of those great years where, at least here in California, we're getting some serious rain. And I was just looking at the paper the other day, and our whole deal is reservoirs. Reservoirs filling up and supplying water. And at this point, and it's raining pretty hard outside right now, at this point, the reservoirs are over their capacity, and there's water coming off on the what do they call it? Discharging water in certain reservoirs because it's so much water coming in. But hey, I love it. I love the rain. I might have mentioned that I get out and hike a lot, and I even hike in the rain. And a lot of my friends go, "You're crazy, man, to get it out there soaking yourself." And but what I do is I go out and I'll get my heavy raincoat on. I'll put my beat up boots on and I'll go out there and walk the trails. Yeah, some of them are muddy, but there's a couple of trails here in Northern California that they've put blue rock on, and that's a really great stone for draining water. Water kind of beads up and then drops into it and soaks through, but it doesn't create mud. It's kind of surface. It's not heavy rock, but anyhow, it's great for hiking. And you know, even when it's coming down hard, sometimes I'll just go out for a 20 minute hike. But about a year ago, I was with a friend and we went hiking. It was a Saturday, I think, and it was a warm day. It was strangely warm, and it was really coming down hard. It was kind of a strange warm weather day. And I remember one of the most unusual things about this hike was we were on this trail called Seaview, which is in Tilden Park in Oakland Hills, Oakland, California. And as we were hiking on this trail, all the animals, all the creatures were coming out. And it's like, hey, there's not going to be any humans, so we're going to come out and walk around. And I saw more salamanders and lizards at that one hike than I've ever seen again. I mean, it was like the most amazing unveiling. And my friend, she was like totally kind of freaked out because it was like, I don't know. You know, we'd see three or four, and then we'd go to a section and we'd see 20. And these are they have this almost iridescent skin kind of salamanders, and they're getting hit with water, so it's even, they're kind of wet. And so, anyhow, it was quite stunning. And there's something about hiking. Look, I mean, you're going to go hiking. No one's going to be on the trail. So that's another kind of cool thing is you're out there. And it was funny because the birds were out, all these strange creatures. We even saw a couple little frogs. And I think it's kind of a clue to nature that, hey, come on out, hang out. Let's walk these trails. Let's cross the areas. Let's hang out. Because there's no humans. There's nobody out there. But that day was quite amazing. I don't think I've had quite a day like that since, when all these creatures were out. And Seaview Trail. By the way, if you're ever in Northern California and like to hike, Seaview Trail is amazing simply because it's very high up and not really high, maybe 1,000 feet, 800,000 feet. And as you're walking on this trail, not only do you see San Francisco, the Golden Gate Bridge and Marin, but as you're walking north, you see Napa Valley, You see the bridge that crosses over to Benicia and Novato. Benicia and Vallejo. And then as you keep walking, you can see up the delta. It's almost like you're on a peninsula, and you can see the big wind-generating fan. Windmills. So anyhow, that's a great hike. Anyhow, I'm going to be putting on my jacket. I've decided I got to go out today, so I'm going to be hiking in the rain. Yeah, so we don't have snow. We have rain here, so I dig it. I'm happy about it. And, hey, we don't have to worry about water for a while because our reservoirs are full. And now it's not happening in Southern California. Southern California is still dry, and there's still areas that are dealing with lack of water. So, but we're happy here in Northern California. Hey, if you listened to last week's program with Richard Casero, I wanted to mention, I spoke to Richard offline, and he is giving me an ebook to place on our website. This ebook's called Breaking the Cathedral Code. And as you remember, we did talk about the cathedrals. And so he has an ebook that he's giving me. And the only way to get that book, go to the website and register. If you've already registered, you're going to get it. And by the way, I am going to be sending out the newsletter. I'm going to be combining it. I sent it out to a few people. If you didn't get it, don't worry. I promise within the next 2 days that it will go out. And for those of you who have not signed up for the newsletter, do so, and you'll get this new ebook by Richard Casero, Breaking the Cathedral Code. Hey, the other thing to do to check out is on the website, I have an article by Gary David that's quite interesting on the Orion Zone in Native culture. And when he was on the show, he talked about this book he had written that basically shows that Native American people followed an ancient cosmological grid where they laid out their cities according to various star clusters, and specifically the Orion star cluster. And you can read about the importance of this cluster and how the cities are designed by going to earthancients.com and scroll to the very bottom. And you'll see the article. It's for free. You can get it for free. Now, I would suggest that you register on Earth Ancients so that you get this ebook, Breaking the Cathedral Code. It's a full ebook by Richard. He wrote it about 3 or 4 months ago. And rather than creating a whole book, it's probably an extension of his other book that he discussed, written in stone, which is what we talked about last week. So get it, get on the website. Hey, and get the regular email and the newsletter. So each, I think I'm going to do it every 2 months now. I don't think I have time to do it every month. So check it out. Earth Ancients is brought to you by Gaia, and Gaia is offering a 7,000 catalog of material. Each month there's new shows. This week, Linda Moulton Howe is presenting a program called Truth Hunter. And if you don't know who Linda is, I know Linda quite well. She wrote a number of books on the cow mutilations years ago, and is very big on the alien encounters and UFO contactees. This new series apparently is her research on extraterrestrial communications. And this is ETs contacting people on a subconscious level, relaying information. And it's her research and some of the latest discoveries with abductees. She's quite a forerunner. She's been around probably 3 decades. I've known Linda for at least 25 years. So check it out. It's on Gaia. And to get the special promo, it's 99 cents to start. Go to Gaia.com /earthancients. That's GAIA.com/earthancients, and you can see the entire program. The news last week on these amazing native kivas, and what they discovered is there's this advanced geometry built into them, and this geometry is so advanced that they are trying to figure out how these Pueblo people designed these. And I was curious about that, and I wanted to follow up. So I gave our native consultant, Clifford Mahuti, a call. And for those of you who don't know who Clifford Mahuti is, he's a Zuni elder of the Kachina clan, and he is an expert on ancient culture. And this is what he had to say about that. But is there something about the sacred geometry in native culture that is – It creates power, or is it just that when you're in that building, it's designed to absorb earth energies, or what? How does that work?
No, the sacred geometry is based upon not only the layouts, because if you connect that to the south Mesoamerica, even clear over to the Peru people, into the Machu Picchu. And some of the stuff that David Churles talks about, you know.
Okay.
So they were all connected. It's just that people really never have really looked at it from a very broad mapping, so to speak, until the Settlex came about.
Okay.
But we do know about, there's 19 in the system that I belong to. There's 19 different locations.
When you say system, you mean system of the Hopi system or Zuni system?
Zuni system. Each one of them has their own migration route. The Hopis have their own. The Zunis have their own because of their groups. It's a tribal designation. If you really want to get to the basic stuff, their star person connection, or what we call a god system. You know, the gods that, for example, in Hopi it's called Ma'asau, and it's like a Yoda complex. And in Zuni, it's the ones that were guided from the Lumerian culture.
Mm-hmm.
And so they would go and they migrated. And the reason they migrated, according to the teachings, is that they were looking for the center of where they're supposed to be. And they finally settled after they found out. I think what happened was that there were some, like for example, in Zuni, we call it the middle of the earth. And you go to another culture, it's also their middle of the earth. And recent times, there have been some things that have been uncovered that are very, you know, falls in the category of, in a way, like a generating type systems.
Mm-hmm.
Like, for example, rocks or material that are some combination of metal, quartz, and a lot of instruments that had been located way there by the Star Brother system. And the only reason you don't find them in Mexico is because the Spanish tore them out and took them back to wherever, Spain or wherever.
So when you say these generators, are these like pieces of quartz crystal embedded in stone, or what were they embedded in?
Well, they were in the what the white man called the Kivas.
Okay.
See, they were not Kivas per se at that time, because there was no need for Kivas. It's only after the Star Brothers left that they had to have a ritualistic place that they created the Kivas concept.
Mm-hmm.
For example, at Chaco, they say that this is a great Kiva. It was never a Kiva. There's no entrances to that circular structure. And it's a huge one. It's at least 200 feet in diameter, if you look at the pictures. If you look at it, there's niches on the wall, and there's no doorway, and there's a lot of, like, boxes inside, so they must have been, like, generator things.
Right.
That on the foundations.
Mm-hmm. So that was just a brief look from a native's perspective on this advanced geometry that I reported on last week. You can read the article. It's on the Facebook Earth Ancients. Go to the group page. And they found this information by using satellite technology. And as Clifford was saying, that these are very, very advanced buildings. And what I didn't know, which is what he was talking about, is that they also placed various types of generation, energy generation items, devices within these temples. And I guess you had to crawl into them from the top. Most of the roofs are gone. So he said they're not kivas. They're generating, energy generating rooms. So anyhow, you can read more about it on the Facebook page, and I'm going to keep following up on that, because I find that fascinating, that entire history of those buildings fascinating. And they can only guess at a few thousand years right now, but I think that they're much older. So today we're talking about longevity, and you know, it's funny, we're curious. We're curious as a civilization about aging. Nobody wants to grow old. We have an industry in America, it's the staying young industry, which means that, you know, we want to have our faces lifted, we want to, you know, eat the best foods, exercise. It's all about staying young, staying in shape so that we don't age. You know, in America, recent estimates are that the average American lives to his early 80s. In Europe, it's mid-80s. And in Japan, it's late 80s. And they're actually a very old-lived civilization. But why are we so preoccupied with growing old? Is it some memory of a time when we were actually able to live a lot longer, or is it just envy? My guest today is Nick Redfern, and Nick's written a new book called Immortality of the Gods: Legends, Mysteries, and the Alien Connection to Eternal Life. And I find this quite an interesting subject, simply because we read about ancient beings in the Bible. Noah lived to be 800 years old. Methuselah lived to be 969 years old. And there's a number of very long-lived people. I mean, how did they live to be such great age? Now, one thing I thought about when I was looking at this book is that these are what they call pre-flood individuals. And you know, I mean, some people believe the flood was over 10,000 years ago. Some say 12, some say 4,000 BC, which would be 6,000 years. But were these a different kind of a human being? Have we changed? Have we evolved? Have we, you know, become decrepit and only able to live to be 75, 80, 85. If we're lucky, we live to be 90. Nick, how you doing? This is a great book.
Excuse me. Thanks, Cliff.
It's very interesting.
Thanks.
The last time we had you on, you spoke about Weapons of the Gods. And I'm just curious, was there something that you discovered in that research that kind of tripped into your consciousness on ancient longevity and these God figures and these figures in the Bible who were very long-lived?
Not really, no. What happened was that the publisher, New Page Books, asked me if I'd be interested in doing, you know, sort of ancient astronaut-type books. But, you know, I'm someone who's got specific interests in that area. I wrote Bloodline of the Gods in 2015, and
right.
then Weapons of the Gods, which dealt with sort of ancient nuclear warfare last year. And this year there's Immortality of the Gods. And they're sort of the three areas that really interest me. So I said, well, you know, why don't we do a trilogy of books? One of the three subjects that really interest me. So this will be the third and last of the Gods book that I'll do.
Because I feel,
you know, I've got a lot of other interests as well. And I think if you try and focus on one subject, there's a danger that after so long, you'll stretch yourself out and, you know, books will be filled with padding and because you're running out of material. I felt a good way to do it would be to do a trilogy of the ones that really interest me and, you know, filled with good information and then get out, you know, and then move on to something else.
Interesting. Yeah. I have to ask you, the book's very thorough about going through the early biblical individuals. Of course, the Anunnaki were known to be very long-lived. But in your research, did you discover anything about these biblical characters, Noah, Methuselah, and these other guys that could possibly link them to an advanced pre-Diluvian culture?
Well, you know, that's one of the sort of the, I guess, sort of the cornerstones of the story, in the sense that, you know, we're dealing with people who, as you said in the introduction, appear to have had incredibly long lifespans. Now, those who are sort of skeptical of this scenario have stated, you know, and quite reasonably stated that, well, that maybe in the distant past, you know, the calendar was sort of deciphered differently and, you know, which had a bearing on age. You know, we view age today by the fact that, you know, the Earth goes around the sun, you know, in 365 days is a year. So for us, a year is 365 days. But I mean, if we trimmed 365 days down to 36.5 days, you know, 10% of the full amount, 36.5 days, instead of living to 80, we would live to 800. Do you see what I mean? It's just basically down to how we count the calendar. But in saying that, one of the reasons why I think that isn't the answer is because, you know, the Bible specifically talks about only certain individuals that achieve these massive lifespans. You know, it isn't like the Bible tells of everybody living to that length. It was just sort of key figures, if you like, famous figures. I mean, to give you an example, this story of Methuselah and Noah and so on actually goes back to the story of the story of Adam. For example, he was supposedly fathered a son when he was 130, and the son was named Seth. And and Adam supposedly lived for another 800 years. Seth had a massive lifespan. And then there was Enosh, who at the age of 105 became a father, lived to in excess of 800. And then there's Methuselah, who you mentioned, who is allegedly the oldest person in the Bible, who lived to 969. Now, of course, you know, again, we have to be balanced in the sense that, you know, we're dealing with an ancient book which has been, you know, reinterpreted, which has been, you know, studied and translated. So, you know, we have to keep all that in mind as to exactly how much of the story, you know, is valid and how much is down to belief versus evidence. So all of these factors come into play. But one of the reasons, again, why I think this story has validity is because if it was just a one-off story in one ancient book, then people could reasonably say, well, you know, there's nothing else to it. However, we find in numerous ancient books and texts from all across the planet that they have stories of sort of, you know, the gods coming down and taking human wives and creating what were called demigods who would have extensive lifespans, you know, and the gods themselves were known for being immortal. And sometimes they would sort of give their immortality secrets over to certain humans. So when you put all these stories together, you know, it's kind of like, you know, the whole issue of is there smoke without fire, etc. You know what I mean? But there's clearly something going on a worldwide basis in the past that led people to believe that the gods had huge lifespans and that those lifespans could also be sort of translated over to the or transferred over to the people as well.
Okay, so that's, if I'm getting you right, that's a genetic kind of a thing. Or are you saying that you discovered something within the Bible or within your research that shows that these pre-flood people had a diet of certain foods or they had technology? I'm just curious because, you know, 800 years is mind-blowing. 969 years is phenomenal.
Yeah, and I think one of the important things that, you know, that you just brought up about, you know, the stories and so on, you know, and is there sort of evidence and things like that? Well, one of the intriguing things is one of the books that was left out of the Bible was the Book of Enoch. Now, the Book of Enoch actually tells a very interesting story all about Noah and his very earliest years, and it talks about how, I mean, bear in mind, you know, the book was written, you know, thousands of years ago as well, but the Book of Enoch talks about how when Noah was born, he didn't look like a regular person. His skin was extremely white, I mean, literally like a sheet of paper white. His hair was white, and he had these shining eyes. Now, some people have suggested that maybe he was an albino. But in saying that, you know, that doesn't necessarily fit in with the entirety of the story. But what's intriguing is that some researchers have suggested from their interpretations of the old text that the Anunnaki may have looked kind of like albinos look, you know, very pale and they have these sort of pinkish eyes. So it's intriguing that Noah supposedly had this incredible lifespan. And according to the Book of Enoch, he actually didn't look like a regular person. He looked very unusual to the point where his own father was sort of fearful of, you know, of how the baby looked. So that in itself, I think, is an important factor too.
Well, you're getting into hybrids, which means that maybe there was some DNA or in vitro fertilization of some kind,
yeah.
You know, to create this very long lived. Now, do we know if his parents were long lived or it was just Noah?
Oh, yeah, the entire lineage through Adam, you know, through Noah reportedly, they all, you know, this entire family ancestral line all had this one key factor, massive lifespan, sort of close to 1,000.
That's just amazing to consider someone who could live to be that old. In your book, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, I mean, it's incredible from our perspective, but I mean, if you're born into that kind of lifespan, I suppose you don't really think about it. And of course, you know, there's a situation where if you're going to live to 900 or 1,000, then you want to make sure the aging process, you know, is as slow as well. For example, you know, we are in old age, you know, by the time we're sort of 75, 80. You know, the worst scenario could be is that you know, when you live to 800, but you reach old age at 80, and then you've got 700 years in front of you as an 85-year-old guy, you know.
Yeah.
That wouldn't be an ideal situation. So, you know, if they were active and, you know, still fathering children at, like, you know, when they're hundreds, then clearly it wasn't just they lived to an old age. It was clearly also that the aging process was slowed down as well.
Okay, so you didn't find any technology or any hints of technology in these pre-biblical guys. Where I remember seeing a movie one time, and it was an alien and human interactive movie where the alien would go into this chamber and lay in there, and when he was in there, it completely rejuvenated him and in some forms reduced his aging. But you didn't find any evidence of that.
There are a couple of stories. I mean, ironically, there's one, you know, most people, I say ironically, because most people think about this, and they think of ancient Middle Eastern countries, you know, and, you know, Africa and places like that, which do play heavily into the story. But there actually is a story that comes out of Ireland, of all places, you know, the people of Ireland, for example, you know, had their own cultures and beliefs, you know, thousands of years ago. And there's this one particular story of a man named, or a, well, like a semi-human known as Mananan MacLea. And he was someone who was a very sort of intriguing character. He was like an ancient Irish ruler. And he sort of ruled over much of Ireland between 3200 to literally 600 BC. So, in other words, you know, he had somebody who lived for a very long period of time, allegedly. Now, the story is that he sort of had, you know, he came from like a supernatural lineage, which, you know, today we might call an extraterrestrial lineage. Mm. Now, what's interesting, but he had this strange ship, which was the way it was described, it actually sounds almost like a submarine. It was like a described like a ship, but it could take, you know, it could be used on the water itself and under the water. And it was known as the Wave Sweeper. And it didn't have any masts or sails, which suggests, you know, it had some sort of technology to power it. And there are stories about him having various weapons that sound almost like sort of surface-to-air missiles, that kind of thing. But to get to your point about technology, there was supposedly this strange contraption, if you like, known as the Cauldron of Regeneration, which supposedly could bring the dead back to life. And supposedly that was part of his story as well. So,
yeah.
You know, it's... We have that angle, and the other angle we have, which is a very important one that is sort of a theme throughout the book, it's not so much technology, it's more medicine, I think, is the fact that you find numerous reports from all around the world of where the gods would have these specific cocktails or food which they would intake and which ensure their ongoing immortality. For example, you know, you have, like in ancient Greece, you have the ambrosia of the gods. In India, they had what's called Amrita. Then you have this mysterious substance in the Bible, which essentially called manna, you know, manna from heaven, which fed the, you know, the Israelites for, you know, for decades. So when you find these various sort of elixirs and things like this throughout the world, and that they kept the gods young and, you know, never dying, and when they were specifically given to people, their sort of you know, their bodies began to change as well, to the point where the aging process for them slowed down too. You know, sounds like we're dealing with, you know, a science which had tapped into immortality, and that, you know, kind of like you make a diabetic well by, you know, giving them insulin, you know.
Yeah.
Or somebody's got cancer, they have, you know, chemotherapy, and it seems to achieve longevity, you ingest this particular substance.
Yeah, it sounds like a very advanced science. I want to get into manna in a bit, because that's fascinating. But while we're talking about ancient figures, very old figures, The story of Gilgamesh is very interesting simply because he is, and you talk about him in your book, and I want you to describe a little bit about what you discovered. He's possibly part human and part Anunnaki, which is a ET interaction with a human.
Yeah.
But I guess he lives for about 130 years. But what did you discover about him? I find what you write very interesting.
Well, yeah, I mean, the whole story of Gilgamesh is an intriguing one. The story actually dates back to about 4,000 BC, so we're talking roughly 6,000 years ago. And our information on King Gilgamesh comes from what's called the Epic of Gilgamesh. And he was a ruler over Sumeria, a Sumerian ruler, and held sway over what's called Uruk. And it's a city situated in the ancient parts of Sumer. Now, it's been suggested that Gilgamesh was part human and part Anunnaki, or as he became known, like a demigod. You know, he was sort of semi-human. Now, he didn't reportedly, you know, achieve the lifespans of people like Noah or Methuselah, but the story is that he ruled over Uruk for 130 years. Now, nobody really knows how old he was when he came to power. You know, he could have been a boy, you know, like some of the Egyptian pharaohs were just young children when they came to power. Or, on the other hand, he could have been 50. If he was 50, you know, he would have been 180 when he died. So, whatever the answer, the genes, if you like, that were sort of possibly part alien and part human, allowed him to reach this age of 130. But what's particularly notable is that he clearly knew the secrets of immortality because he became obsessed with trying to find the answer to it and try and find a way to prevent dying. So he clearly knew that the gods, so to speak, were able to have lifespans far more than he was destined to have. And I think the reason why his life was shorter was because he wasn't sort of pure alien. You know, he was he was semi-human. But what's interesting is that he was described as being around about 16 feet tall, which, you know, is pretty incredible. But again, that sort of applies to the story of the Anunnaki, where they were reputed to be very tall, and, you know, you have these stories and legends, not just in the Bible, but elsewhere, of the giants coming down, you know.
It is curious. It is curious. I do want to ask you about the Anunnaki, which are fascinating. Zachariah Sitchin really gets into them quite thoroughly in The 12th Planet and in his other books. But these are extremely, extremely long-lived humanoid. I think what the average is 400,000 years. I mean, it's just mind-blowing to consider that a flesh and bone human, or not human, but an alien in human form would live that long. Well, what do we know about the Anunnaki?
Well, I mean, you're right. Most of what we do know from the Anunnaki comes from Zachariah Sitchin's interpretations, you know, of the entire phenomenon, if you like. Now, one of the things that's sort of important to note is that, you know, the Anunnaki aren't sort of, like, contrary to what a lot of people have said, like a new phenomenon or anything like that. You know, I mean, it's kind of like, you know, the history of the Bible, you know, the story of the Anunnaki equally goes back thousands of years. It's not like that Sitchin suddenly uncovered the mystery, you know, a couple of decades ago. I mean, for example, you can find, you know, the stories of the Anunnaki throughout the, you know, the thousands of years old histories of the Sumerian culture. The big question is, of course, how you interpret who or what the Anunnaki actually were. And having sort of read and deciphered and the text and so forth, Sitchin came to believe that they were extraterrestrials from some faraway world. And he theorized that it may be a planet, or may have been a planet, that was operated in our solar system, but its orbit was so huge that it only came by the Earth every several thousand years, and that when it did, the massive gravitational pull caused chaos on the planet, and that he felt that that was sort of tied in with the whole issue of, you know, the flood and all the world's flood legends. You know, there are numerous ones.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
He felt that that the reason why Noah was so essentially told to build the ark, so to speak, was because the Anunnaki knew that when their planet got close again, there was going to be massive disaster. So in essence, they knew what was coming, and they picked certain people to get prepared to try and, you know, sort of survive the onslaught. And from there, you know, Sitchin really has sort of, you know, dominated the Anunnaki story up until his death, and a lot of people have sort of followed on the research.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's an intriguing angle, the idea of this sort of spacefaring race that came to the Earth, you know, maybe even hundreds of thousands of years ago, and possibly genetically altered some of the early primitive humans, used them as a slave race, as Sitchin thought. And then from there, you know, actually, to a degree at least, were friendly to us. You know, wasn't just like a sort of, you know, like a malicious slave type situation. And they tried to help us and, you know, sort of advance us. So, you know, it's a fascinating story. But I mean, when you get to this issue, when you said about, you know, it's incredible to imagine living to that sort of lifespan, well, it can actually be, you know, sort of explained quite easily why it happens. It revolves around something that's known as the Hayflick limit, and basically this is it's a situation where when it comes to the issue of how and why cells age, for a normal person, a human being, our cells only reproduce, or actually replicate is a better word, between 40 and 60 times. After that, they're not able to divide anymore. And what that involves then is that, you know, cells start to degrade, and then, you know, like us, one day they go belly up, you know, and they just not, you know, don't work anymore. But if we could find a way to continue to replicate, you know, the human cells so that, you know, they continue to divide, and we're in a situation where they don't degrade, if we could not only find how to do that, but continually upgrade it and keep on reproducing it, then in theory, we would have immortality. But it would be reliant on ensuring that you constantly, you know, like I said, like a diabetic, you constantly got to take your medicine to remain well. And it's kind of like the same situation here, that the gods had to constantly take ambrosia, you know, or amrita to achieve longevity.
Let's talk about that. The Anunnaki were obsessed with gold. And as Sitchin talks about in his books, their primary reason for coming to Earth was to mine gold, and they mined it very thoroughly. And according to him, in his book, the use of the gold was to somehow support their atmosphere, to some kind of a protective shield their atmosphere was destroying in their world, which I thought was quite interesting. But my question to you is, and you talk about this quite a bit in your book, that in a certain form, in a powdered form, gold may possess certain chemical reactions that produce longevity. How does that work?
Well, yeah, I mean, just so people sort of understand the story of the Anunnaki, there were two reasons essentially for them having this obsession and mining for gold. As you mentioned, the first one was to try and allegedly plug holes in their atmosphere by releasing, you know, billions of tons of gold dust into the atmosphere. Now, ironically, Dr. Edward Teller, one of sort of the most brilliant scientists, you know, the 20th century, he actually thought that this would work too. You know, the idea of, with our ozone layer, if it degraded too much, you know, we could release, you know, billions of tons of some sort of dust into the atmosphere and essentially plugged the holes. So that was the one angle. But then the other one revolves around what's become known as white powder gold. And the story is a very sort of interesting but weird one. And it suggests that one of the main reasons to essentially harvest, so to speak, the gold was that it could actually be using almost like what we call an ancient type of alchemy. You know, alchemy is this mysterious science, if you like, that can turn sort of base metals like tin and lead into silver and gold. And so essentially it was the manipulation of the gold. It's sort of like an atomic structure, so to speak. But a lot of research has been done into this particular issue of white powder gold. And one of the people who's done more than anybody else probably in the more recent years is Jim Mars, who's written a number of books on, you know, various mysteries and so forth. But the whole angle of, you know, gold actually having the ability to provide immortality, you know, it sounds bizarre, but it's also known as high-spin monatomic gold powder. Now, a lot of research is actually being done right now into the means by which gold can actually be utilized to, for example, help the cure for cancer. One of the places that is really at the forefront of doing this is Rice University in Texas. Now, in June 2014, they put a press release out saying that their work had demonstrated that the process could kill off cells that were cancerous but wouldn't harm non-cancerous cells or organs, which is one of the problems that often happens, you know, when people have chemotherapy. It can sometimes cause cause problems as well. But what's particularly interesting is that what the people at Rice found out was that if you inject a particular solution of non-toxic gold, what are called colloids, tiny spheres of gold that are thousands of times smaller than a living cell, it can actually have a significant bearing on wiping out the cancer. So, you know, that doesn't necessarily demonstrate, well, it doesn't demonstrate immortality, but what it does do is demonstrate that gold is now finally being seen by us as a means, like an alternative means to help, you know, the world's worst disease. So when you look at it from that perspective, as our technology develops, we might find ourselves in the same position where the Anunnaki did hundreds of thousands of years ago, when they realized that, you know, synthesizing gold even more could potentially end up, you know, with where you just don't age anymore, never mind be resistant to disease.
That's interesting because when you said colloidal gold, one of the big health products right now is colloidal silver.
Yeah.
And it's used for all kinds of – I tried it years ago. I don't know. I haven't tried it since, but it's not cheap. But it's supposed to have tremendous health properties, and I think one of them was revitalizing tissue of some kind, internal tissue, because you take it as a liquid. But I thought that I think that's kind of cool.
Yeah, and you know, again, the reason why I don't write these stories off is because, you know, we're now starting to utilize the things that were reportedly utilized thousands of years ago, but that so many people have relegated them to myth and legend. Until now, we're starting to see that our technology is mirroring what they were doing. So.
Okay, so let's talk about manna. Now, is manna the gold, the white powder? Because I want to talk right now about ancient Egypt, and you have a whole chapter on ancient Egypt, and they were very focused on the afterlife, which, of course, is you've passed on.
Yeah.
But they were also, according to you in your research, fascinated by longevity properties in white powder gold.
Yeah, well, what's interesting about the Egyptians, you know, is that they were fascinated with life, with longevity, with the afterlife. And one of the important things to note is that, you know, with the when the sort of the leaders and the rulers and the important people died, you know, they were preserved. In other words, you know, they weren't just buried or cremated. They went to a great deal of length to try and preserve the dead in the way they looked when they were alive. In other words, an argument could be made they were sort of emulating the gods who never died. And so they would try and ensure that, you know, the pharaohs never died, really, by trying to keep them physically intact, so to speak. So, again, that sort of leads me to believe that they had an understanding that the gods never changed. You know, they never grew old. They kind of had that almost like a Peter Pan scenario, you know, the boy who never grew up, that sort of thing. And so for that reason, I think they hadn't achieved it, but they were trying in their own far more less technical way, less scientific way, they were trying to emulate the ability to survive. But in terms of the whole issue, you know, of Egypt and so forth, you know, we've got the story of Exodus in the Old Testament, you know, where, excuse me, where Moses takes the Israelites out of bondage and slavery, as it was known, to Mount Sinai and then finally on to Canaan. Now, you know, there's a story in the Old Testament of how the Israelites, you know, they were went on their exodus from Egypt. You know, they were really struggling. And then suddenly, you know, there was this sort of supernatural substance known as manna that essentially was found scattered all across the ground and that reportedly came down from the skies, you know, and God sort of thundered from the skies that everything was going to be okay. And manna was this sort of strange, it wasn't a liquid, you know, like amrita or ambrosia, but it was like a, you know, it was a foodstuff, it was a food item. And reportedly, you know, it nourished them for decades. Now, what manna really was, you know, we don't know. But again, the fact that it came from the skies, the fact that, you know, the voice of God was heard and that, you know, God was going to solve the problem, again, it demonstrates sort of that manna, as I said, came from the skies. It came from the gods. And, you know, there aren't many substances where, you know, you could pretty much live on one thing and not at some point either get sick or have a deficiency. You know, you could probably live on nothing but potato chips if you tried, but over time it wouldn't do your system much good. But if you ate enough every day, you would still get full, you know. But according to the old stories, you know, it's according to the old tales and so forth, manna itself not only filled their belly, so to speak, but it actually also nourished them. So, you know, it was a mysterious substance that, you know, covered just about everything, not just, you know, that starvation, but also kept the people healthy as well.
You are fascinated with ETs and their connection with Earthlings, and you have quite a bit of your book, Gus's very long-lived ETs, and also some other things we're going to talk about in a second here. Can you talk about, and this is almost present day, apparently an ET named Valent Thor, who was known to people in the Pentagon. And what was his interaction, and how did you discover this individual?
Well, the story of Valiant Thor was actually written about in 1960 by a guy named Frank Stranges. And Frank Stranges was one of the people who in the 50s and 60s was sort of one of the main characters in the whole contactee movement. The contactees were people who claimed face-to-face encounters with very human-looking aliens. They were sort of usually slightly taller than us, sometimes a little bit shorter, but they would have long hair. And, you know, they would meet people in desert locations and warn them of, you know, the dangers of nuclear war and things like that. And they became very much almost like a movement, you know, where people would follow the contactees, etc., and listen, hang on to their every word. Now, Frank Stranges was one of these, and he wrote this book, Stranger at the Pentagon, in 1960. And the book told the story of this very human-looking extraterrestrial, supposedly known as Valiant Thor. Now, according to Frank Strange's story, it wasn't just Valiant Thor that had sort of infiltrated the Pentagon, but numerous other eerily human-looking extraterrestrials. Now, the story was that although they'd sort of infiltrated the Pentagon and the government and possibly in numerous countries as well, the term infiltration, in this sense at least, shouldn't be sort of viewed as sinister. It was like a benevolent infiltration to try and prevent us from, you know, destroying ourselves. And according to Frank Strange's Valiant Thor sort of constantly looked about 35. Now, over the years, various other people have come forward claiming to have met Valiant Thor in the 1990s and the 2000s. And I actually talk about several people who are named in the book who claim these experiences with this guy 40, 50 years later. And they claim that the one photograph that Frank Strange's had of Valiant Thor in the 50s, supposedly he looked exactly the same today, but except, as you would imagine, clothing was different and his hairstyle was different. But mm-hmm. they were sure it was the same person. And he was still giving the same message out that certain select people had been chosen, to perform specific tasks on Earth to prevent, you know, a massive worldwide disaster from happening. Now, again, if that's true, then clearly Valiant Thor was someone who had also achieved either immortality or massive longevity because, you know, unless you have a really good plastic surgeon, you're not going to look at like 35 as you do at 75, you know.
So, yeah.
And I don't think even a plastic surgeon could make you really look 35, you know, no, when you're 75.
Plastic surgeries, they don't look good after like the third.
No,
or
they kind of look like, you know, they're stuck in a wind tunnel, you know, or they're
exactly,
you know, that what they call the trout pout and all that kind of stuff. So, but he apparently looked absolutely just normal, like a regular 35-year-old guy. So, you know, I include that story because it's the story of Valiant Thor is quite well known, but far less well known are the latter day encounters with him, which, you know, as I said, if true, really sort of opened the doors to a completely different aspect of who he was or what he was.
It's interesting. You know, your book's filled with really amazing accounts of ET subjects in longevity. And there's one thing I want you to talk about because I just caught it this morning before the show. And this is something that apparently, and I don't know where you get this information, Nick, but it's fascinating, that the Iraqi war, you know, we needed to get Hussein out of there. But one of the other goals from a secret group, I don't know if it's in the Pentagon or not, was to extract evidence of ancient aliens in Iraq, but also to extract information on longevity systems and techniques, and perhaps even evidence of formulas to extend life. Tell us about that. That's fascinating.
Yeah, well, there's been a lot of rumors over the years that, you know, when the Iraqi war broke out, that, yes, you know, the main agenda was to sort of take out Saddam Hussein and so on. But there have been a lot of rumors circulating in the ancient astronaut world and ufology, and also, even more so, in the field of conspiracy theorizing, that there were other reasons as well for going into Iraq. And supposedly one of these was to try and uncover the secrets of immortality. Now, what we do know for sure is that after the invasion, that the Baghdad Museum, which is home to literally thousands and thousands of priceless ancient artifacts, was looted. Now, I don't personally think it was the U.S. government at all that's responsible for what I'm about to talk about. What I think it was,
yeah,
was some sort of like elite, almost like an elite secret society that had a lot of power and influence. And what we know for sure is that the pillaging, if you like, of the Baghdad Museum was not done at random. You know, it wasn't just like anarchy was breaking out. It kind of looked like that. But when an inventory was done on everything, it was clear that certain areas of the museum had been specifically targeted. It wasn't random. And a lot of the items that went missing, some of them fortunately were recovered, but and some weren't. But a lot of it all focused around the story of Gilgamesh that we talked about earlier, because the city that he ruled over, Uruk, was actually in what is today modern-day Iraq. So you had this quest on to try and, you know, find out any data, materials, technology perhaps even, that possibly could have sort of opened the doors to understanding how Gilgamesh lived to 130 and that may have had a bearing on immortality. And a few people have told me over the years sort of snippets of stories of sort of secret groups trying to figure out, you know, the key to immortality. And but as I point out, you know, these stories are, so far, they're still at the story stage. That doesn't mean there's nothing to it. It just means we've sort of hit a brick wall because the data is so fragmentary. But maybe if we keep digging, you know, we're going to find more information and more data. But it is fascinating that, you know, if you sort of, if you Google like Iraq War, immortality, things like that, you'll find a lot of stories. And the story itself, the core story, was shared with a lot of researchers. And again, you know, it's that sort of a smoke without fire angle, you know. When you have so many people receiving this story, and from different angles and different perspectives and different people, then you begin to think, well, you know, there is something to this.
No, I actually remember seeing photographs of the looted main museum, and and I thought it was quite weird. Now, you also mentioned potential seeking of immortality, elixirs or information. Was that like another kind of a library, or is that was that more ancient texts that were removed?
Well, it wasn't so much, it wasn't like elixirs, but it was sort of ancient artifacts, texts, that kind of thing.
Okay.
And there were also rumors of, you know, this group, whatever they were, sort of traveling around Iraq and trying to find the sort of final resting place of Gilgamesh, and perhaps try and find other sort of underground areas that, you know, are sort of long buried, but where some of the ancient technologies might actually now still be hidden, you know, or not so much hidden, but just, we just not being deliberately hidden today, but we just don't know where they are, you know.
We don't know how it is, what it looks like.
No, that's the problem. And of course, you know, when it comes to things like white powder gold, you may have an understanding of it, but replicating it could be what's slowing us down. It's kind of like if you were to sort of time travel a car back to the 1600s, you know, they might understand it's meant to go forward, and they probably would realize after a while that you turn the steering wheel, then the vehicle moves. But if they hadn't, you know, if they've got no gasoline, it's not going to go as it should do, because gasoline couldn't be created back then, as at least, you know, in the form that we have it today for cars. So in other words, even if we understand to a degree some of this technology, and maybe even if some of it was recovered in Iraq, it doesn't necessarily mean we have the science to replicate it. You know, we've got to develop the science before we can actually make use of the technologies.
Yeah, I mean, was kind of one of my questions. You can't take gold and just consume it. It'll kill you.
No, has to be I wouldn't developed. Recommend anybody does that.
it'll kill you. I mean, poison you. You have to, I mean, it has to be in a form that the body can absorb. And so that's why it has to be created in tinctures. That's something that's quite fascinating when I think of consuming gold and what the properties would be within the gold that would, you know, create this longevity in the cells.
Well, I mean, one of the things that I've sort of pondered on is whether or not the actual issue of literally sort of drinking some sort of gold-based elixir, maybe that's just sort of the legend and the mythology and the and sort of the folklore that spread down as, you know, cultural periods, you know, and translated, etc. Because if we look at how it's, you know, it's now being used in the cure for cancer, you know, that doesn't involve a person actually, you know, literally drinking it. So I do sometimes wonder if, you know, when stories are passed down orally and they're translated and retranslated, maybe it was assumed that in the distant past the ancients were drinking this substance, but maybe it was something that was, you know, refined and injected into them. You know, it may not literally have been, you know, you chug down every morning a pint of whatever this stuff is, you know.
Yeah, or it could be part of a two-part system. You are injected or you consume something, and then you walk under a certain lamp of energy light, or you walk into outside, or you have to have something that triggers the rejuvenation. Who knows?
Yeah, we just don't know. And I think, you know, the fact that, like I said, with ambrosia and amrita, you know, they constantly took it. That, as a, to me, that kind of smacks of reality, you know, just the idea of just having one injection when you're 6 months old and then you're good for the next million years or whatever, you know, that kind of doesn't sound valid. But it does sound, you know, how like somebody who's got high blood pressure, they have to take their medicine every day. You know, somebody who's got epilepsy takes their medicine every day. And I think we could be looking at a similar thing here with, you know, all of these various mysterious elixirs. As long as you took them, you were okay. You know, and that's you know, the beginning and the end of it, really. So,
interesting. You describe a really quite an amazing form of longevity, and it has to do with ETs. We in our present evolution cannot look at souls as you describe them. And you describe one way of longevity, which is moving the soul between bodies. So a person, the soul is in one body, the body ages and then moves and is positioned into another, either clone or another being who is ready to take the body, but it has the same soul. And you actually describe what is known as the Greys, who are working in this field, and I find that fascinating. Can you talk a little bit about how that works?
Yeah, sure. Well, this is sort of like a twofold issue. One is the idea of sort of using cloning, you know, to wear when one body wears out. Essentially, your mind, your soul, however you want to define it, is then sort of downloaded into the next clone. Now, this, you know, hasn't been proved. The one group more than any other that sort of researched this, it's a very controversial angle, is the so-called Raelians, created in the 70s by a man named Claude Rael in France. And it's sort of like an offshoot of the contactee movement. And they actually don't believe that anything sort of survives bodily death. They believe that, you know, when you're 85 and you breathe your last breath, that it's you know, it's lights out, game over, there's, you know, you just don't exist anymore. But they feel that immortality can be achieved by creating highly sophisticated duplicate clones of yourself, and then essentially downloading your entire life experiences, your memories, your character, your emotions, and everything else into this new body. Now, of course, you know, cloning is one thing. Finding a way of being able to literally, you know, transfer a person's mind and memories into another body is quite another thing. Now, whether or not it could be achieved one day, I mean, who knows? But we're not there yet. Now, the other angle you brought up about the Greys, one of the people whose work I talk about in the book is Nigel Kerner. Nigel's written a couple of really good and interesting and almost sort of creepy books about what might be the real agenda of the Greys, these sort of diminutive little creatures with the black heads, the black eyes and the big heads that people talk about, in abductions particularly. Now, what the basic story that Nigel believes is going on is that the Greys are sort of like biological robots. They're not the the original aliens. They may have been constructed by an even more ancient race that we've never actually seen. And they're sort of kind of like, you know, like worker drones, you know, in a bee colony or an ant colony, but they're not born. They're sort of created. They're like a biological robot. And Nigel sort of concluded that they don't have souls because they're biological robots rather than living things. But he feels that they do understand what the soul is, and they're trying to create the situation where they will, you know, by genetic, you know, tinkering and engineering, they will have a soul. And he believes that the sort of the core of abductions and things like that of people is to understand the human soul, and possibly even to make use of it to where they would then have a soul, which kind of creates like a disturbing scenario where we're almost like a farm. You know, they're sort of possibly using people and trying to harvest them in some way so they will have their own souls. So it does get down some, you know, some very dark and sinister pathways. And but I mean, if you look into a lot of abduction accounts, you find a great deal of material centered around the soul. For example, Whitley Strieber, who wrote Communion, you know, which was a massive New York Times bestseller, he was told by the Greys, supposedly their main purpose here was to recycle souls. And this whole issue of soul recycling pops up a lot. You know, it's almost like the scenario in The Matrix, you know, where you've got all these people where we think the real world is the real world, but it's a dream, but we're all living in these pods and we're sort of feeding the machines, you know.
Yeah.
And that's one of the theories that's been put forward, that perhaps, you know, the whole purpose of the Greys is like we're like a farm, and they're constantly recycling human souls, whether for our benefit, theirs, or a bit of both, you know.
It's fascinating. Let's come up to present day, and what can you tell us about the science and the research of immortality? I mean, you have a lot of it in the book, and I'm just curious what you can tell our listeners about what is being done today.
Yeah. Well, as I said, in terms of the science and the technology and try and prevent aging, as I said, it all revolves around this thing called the Hayflick limit, which, you know, concerns how the human cells only divide sort of 40 to 60 times. And then after that, you know, it's all downhill from there, really. But again, as I said, if we could find a way to change that, then we would literally quite literally change everything. Now, there have been sort of a lot of research done in the last couple of years or last 10 years or so trying to figure out how, you know, we might be able to, you know, extend the lifespan to massive degrees. Now, one of the ways that this has been suggested it could actually be done has been put forward by Ray Kurzweil, the famous futurist. And he's talked about how possibly by as early as 2045, we might achieve some sort of immortality. But it would be in the sense of what's known as the singularity, where we become sort of more or less human than we are now, where, for example, we may not become physically immortal, but we could perhaps become digitally immortal, you know, where, again,
right,
it's kind of like the Raelians uploading into, you know, clones. We're talking about, you know, the human mind, our memories, etc., being uploaded into highly sophisticated computers, you know, to where you would live forever, but it would be in sort of like a digital reality kind of world. So whether or not you would consider that immortality, I don't really consider that immortality, because it would take away our humanity, you know, which, you know, I think if you're talking about, for example, physical immortality, then most of the science that's being done now is looking at trying to find ways to prevent cellular degradation. That is sort of the, you know, the primary focus. Now, the only really other science surrounds, you know, the science of eating well, exercise, and things like that. And there's no doubt that has sort of helped us, you know, to sort of achieve a degree of, you know, where we've upped the age limit from sort of the 60s to the 70s to the 80s, and now into the, you know, the 90s, so to speak, almost. I mean, for example, one of the main groups of people on the planet that have longevity are the Eskimos. And I don't think it's coincidence. That's because their primary diet is fish. You know, they don't eat junk food because, you know, there's no... you know, where they live, you know, there's no junk food. You know, they catch their fish, and that's what they primarily live on. So, you know, but that's not, again, immortality. The only way that this could really be achieved would be if, you know, we found a way to slow the aging process. And that's being looked at, but, you know, it's still really in its infancy from our perspective, so.
Well, I have to say that you do actually come up and qualify the current ideas, which is that those of us who do take, and I try to take supplements at least every other day, the supplement combinations may hold the key to a healthier long life and may extend our life into advanced age. And when I say advanced age, for us, advanced age is living into our 90s, and there are there are, like I mentioned at the beginning, you actually have it in your book that the Japanese and there's some cultures in Europe that are kind of secluded do live into their 90s, and some of them actually are into the 100s.
Yeah.
And talk about that, because that's interesting.
Well, yeah, and a lot of this does really come down to diet. You know, I mentioned the Eskimos, their primary foodstuff is fish. You know, the Japanese people, they have, you know, their lifespan is sort of well into the mid to late 80s now. And, you know, their primary, you know, sort of foodstuff is fish. They don't eat a great deal of red meat, you know, which has been shown to, you know, most people like a steak, but it's actually not as good for you as eating chicken breast or, you know, fish. It's
exactly.
But that's just how it is. You know, we can't sort of ban people from doing this or doing that. But one of the things I would say is that the main battle that's on right now is not just to sort of increase lifespan, but to try and ensure that people who live to 85 or 90 spend most of that 85 or 90 years in good health. You know, the worst situation would be living to 85 but going down with a bunch of illnesses at 60. And that's why there's big concerns, particularly with children. You know, childhood obesity and diabetes is really on the rise. And, you know, if that isn't sort of curbed or tackled properly, we could find kids who might sort of live to their 70s but not their 80s, but who are spending the last 30 years of their life, you know, with conditions caused by sort of just bad health and inactivity and things like that. You know, I think probably the generation of kids around now are probably the first generation that really, strange it might sound, that don't play outside anymore. They don't ride their bikes around town, which is what we all used to do, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And you imagine growing up from as a child and barely doing any exercise and, you know, the food's, you know, much bigger and unhealthier today. You can see how when they're 70, they could actually be in a much worse condition than most people would be at 70. So, you know, the big irony is we're looking for all these cures, but we could be faced with the exact opposite, that we become a race of unhealthy people who barely move, you know.
Yeah, and one of the things I just was thinking about is how horrible to be sickly and dealing with degenerative disease and poor health in your 70s and 80s when you could take care of yourself in your younger years with your supplementation and good health and eating and good food to live as long as you can in a good state, because God knows no one likes to be sick.
No, that's right. And I think the more we can do to sort of, you know, combat disease and find ways to, you know, extend the lifespan. I mean, using regular technology, we're not, I don't think, in all probability, going to get much above more 95, really. You know, I mean, because people still degrade, you know, when they're at that age, physically. So I think we might be limited. I think the only way past it is to find a way that, you know, constantly rejuvenates the body. And that's the sort of the key that we're looking for, you know, the key to the door to immortality. Nothing else really is going to do it. You know, eating fruit and vegetables and fish is good, but that's not going to get you to 130. Something's still going to get you, you know. So it's still the unknown science, which the ancients may well have known about and which they may have inherited from extraterrestrials. That is the mystery we've got to solve and try and present that in the present, which existed in the past. And if we can figure out what it was, replicate it, then we could well be on the way then.
So as a final question to you, based on your research, what would you say? And I think you kind of hinted at it that, you know, normal lifestyle, most of us are very sedentary once we retire, getting into our 60s and 70s. These are people that are going to live in their 70s, 80s. But I mean, the trick is to be, as a lot of health related people talk about, is to be physically active, eat a good diet, and have supplements, and take care of yourself. So that's the key to a longer life.
Yeah, and that would not just a longer life, but where you that long life, most of it is spent being more healthy than, like I said, going down with something when you're 40 and then having to deal with it for the next 40 years or whatever.
God, that's horrible. The book is Immortality of the Gods, Legends, Mysteries, and the Alien Connection to Eternal Life. And my guest has been Nick Redfern. Nick, I just saw this book on Amazon. This book just came out a month ago, so it's been out for a while. And what's a website people can read more about what you're up to?
Well, I have a blog, and it's called World of Whatever. So if people Google Nick Redfern, World of Whatever, they'll see my blog. And all the books, including the new one, Immortality of the Gods, are available at Amazon. And Immortality of the Gods, you can also get off the shelves in Barnes & Noble.
Fantastic. Nick, thank you very much. I've really enjoyed speaking with you. And this is a fascinating book. I really suggest that our audience go out and get a copy.
Well, thanks a lot, Cliff. Thank you.
Appreciate it. So that was Nick Redfern, and so much to talk about. We crossed over into the alien side of things. I typically don't do that, but Nick writes very persuasively about these ideas, these concepts, and a lot of this is still going out. Our sponsor Gaia has huge sections on ETs and their interactions with humans today and in the ancient past. And remember, we had Donald Zagaitis on the program, who just finished writing a book called The Sagan Conspiracy, which is still reverberating through the ancient alien community. Here's an acknowledgement and actually a book written about Carl Sagan's paper, scientific paper, acknowledging that ancient aliens were once here on the Earth. Still blows my mind to think about such a prominent scientist writing about this, and I can see why NASA squelched it. It's kind of funny. My guest next week is Will Hart, and the title of the book and the information is The Genesis Race, and this is about ancient history and the unknown ancients and their lifestyles, and a lot of secret society material, which is quite interesting. So I hope you'll join me. All right. I hope you have a great day. Take care.
Run to Old Navy tomorrow and Saturday for the year's biggest denim deal. 2 days only, all jeans are 50% off. That's right, tomorrow and Saturday, all jeans are 50% off at Old Navy and OldNavy.com. But you'd better hurry. It ends Saturday. Valid 224 and 225. Excludes clearance.
Napa know-how.
A Napa guy knows more isn't always better, unless we're talking about full-size vans. These beasts do more than get you from A to B. They have so much space a man can live in it. With shag carpeting, waterbed, and a sweet lava lamp, these mobile abodes have all the comforts of home. With quality parts and plenty of Napa know-how, you can keep the original tiny house running longer, stronger. That's Napa know-how.
Napa know-how.